Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does the population density of large urban communities affect the health, safety, and quality of life to be found there? My guest today would urge us to re-examine our understanding of the evolution of cities from tight urban cores into self-indulgent megalopolises, and at least recognize the benefits of allowing people the freedom and privacy afforded by single-family housing on privately owned land. Robert Brugman is Emeritus Professor of Architectural History at the University of Illinois at Chicago and author of the book Sprawl, A Compact History. He's in town to open the second annual David Dillon Symposium focused on making connections in a networked city with a keynote address this evening at the Magnolia Theater in Dallas. Robert, welcome back to Think.
I'm pleased to be here.
I want to talk about this word sprawl because it makes people very emotional when they hear it. But what does it mean? Does it mean the same thing to all of us?
No, I don't think. I think that's one of the problems with the word. I think what's happened is that people have used that word to think of everything negative they can about the city, and they put it all together into that word. And I think the problem there is that it makes you think that there's some single answer for all of these things, a traffic congestion and fragmented street pattern, that it's all one thing and there's one solution. And I don't think that's actually the case.
It's also not the case that sprawl is like a mid-20th century phenomenon, which many people seem to believe that it is.
No, I think if you take an objective definition of it, rather than the subjective one, like it's something where I don't like the looks of things, if you take an objective definition that it's low density, it's lower density than went before, and it's also unplanned, that it has no great overarching master plan, then I think you can say that sprawl goes back as early as cities, and that whenever people have had the money, the ability, they've tended to want to move out of very congested central areas into areas where they have more privacy, they've got more mobility, and they've got more choice.
So is it inevitable?
No, I don't think it's inevitable. And I think one of the ways that you can test this is you can look at where the wealthiest people in the world live. And when you do that, you see that typically they don't live out in the suburbs or out in a mountaintop in Montana. They live in Paris in the 16th arrondissement. They live in the Upper East Side of New York. They live in places like that, which are very dense. These are some of the densest places in the world. I think the lesson here is that for people with a lot of money, cities can be wonderful, exhilarating. They get all of the benefits. And then if you have a doorman and you have a driver downstairs to take you where you want to go, and you can use your own schedule so you don't have to go at rush hour, then I think the city can be wonderful. I think it's for a lot of average people and people with very little money that it's always been very interesting for them to be able to get out of the city and have a lot of the things that people who have a lot of money in the city can have because they control their own house on a street in a suburb.
The other interesting concept of sprawl is that it's everybody else lives in sprawl, but your neighborhood is your neighborhood.
Oh, absolutely. And so some of the most strident antagonists of sprawl are people that live in the last subdivision out, and they don't want to see that next subdivision to build because that's going to ruin their view and their access to the countryside. So that's one aspect of it. But the other thing that's so funny about sprawl is that some of the very same people that are so counter to sprawl are people that live in central cities. And they don't want sprawl at the edge, but on the other hand, they certainly don't want a lot more density, more cars, more noise where they live. So it's a kind of a deadlock situation. If you can't have it out at the edge and you don't want to ruin the existing neighborhoods, well, where's all the population supposed to go?
I want to talk about this idea of planning and the way that it shapes a metropolitan region, because on the one hand, urban planning can be a remarkable thing. It can allow areas to be orderly and to function properly and well. And yet when people talk about the things that they really love about the most vibrant cities that we might travel to or live in, what we tend to love about them is the organic nature of life within those cities.
Yes, I think that's a very good observation. Certainly, planning has had major triumphs. So it's hard to imagine for me in Chicago, the city of Chicago, without the lakefront parks. And that's entirely a legacy of planning. But on the other hand, when you think about it for a moment, most of the places, as you observe, that we really like are places like, well, let's say Uptown Dallas, or their Greenwich Village in New York City, or the medieval part of Paris. There were no planners when these were done. So there's something ironic, something maybe disturbing about the fact that a lot of the places we like best are places that were done before there was any planning.
Why is the aesthetics such a major component of our dislike of sprawl?
Well, I think that we underestimate very dramatically the importance of aesthetics. I think that for most people, what they see when they're looking out of the window of their living room, what they see when they're looking out of the windshield of their car, is as important to them as just about anything else in life. Now, it's hard to register that. You can't put a dollar sign on it. But I think that for most people, this is hugely important. Now, the problem here is that aesthetic preferences vary dramatically according to people's position in life, how much money they have, their class structure. All of that changes dramatically from person to person. And so it's very hard to know what most people will find really attractive. So some people think that living in a high-rise in the center of Dallas is the most wonderful thing in the world. They love that view. But for other people, that would be sheer agony because what they want to be is close to the ground, close to where their kids are going to play. But these things which go from aesthetics over into functional aspects, I think they're very hard to distinguish between those two. And I think that aesthetic component is something that is inherent in human beings, that is very, very important.
So when we make judgments about the inferior aesthetics of sprawl areas or of, you know, suburbs and exurbs, does time heal that? You know, in 50 years, will we look at the things that people decry as McMansions today and say, weren't those fantastic old houses they built back?
Yeah, I think it is so difficult for anyone, even myself, to believe that we're going to look at these strip centers in 50 years and want to make them historic landmarks and preserve them and save the original signage from the Dunkin' Donuts. But I think that history tells us that that's probably going to happen. So if you look at, for example, let's say the 19th century British row houses, they did miles and miles of those. Now, for the people that moved there, this was practically heaven. They were moving out of the congestion of the city. But for the people who were looking at those, who were the artistic and intellectual elite, this was the worst thing that ever happened to London. It was ruining the countryside. It was developers out to get the last cent from every square inch of land. So it's interesting that these complaints that we hear about sprawl are evergreen. They've been happening since the time of the Romans.
It's interesting to me. I live at a 60-year-old house that is just a ranch house, not architecturally spectacular. And I bought it because it was what I could afford in the neighborhood I wanted to live in. And recently people say, oh, mid-century modern, what a good choice. And it wasn't a choice like that at all. And I wonder why we don't recognize, you know, that people who now find, you know, 1920s cottages charming, that maybe these things will be appealing as time goes on, that have been not considered to be very important.
I wish I knew the answer to that. I think maybe as an historian or historians generally are aware of the cyclical nature of things, I think there's something inherent in the way human beings are hardwired, that something that satisfies one generation is going to be looked at askance by the next, and that process has been continuous. So if you look over history, it seems that that's almost invariably the case, that you're always rejecting what the parents wanted and you're going back to what the grandparents wanted. Why we don't understand this when we're making prescriptions for the city is something I don't understand. It seems that most planners believe that, well, we made mistakes in the past. We shouldn't have done that public housing. We shouldn't have done the urban renewal, but we got it right now. And I've always found that very strange. But I suppose if you have to be a decision maker, you're going to have a lot of confidence in your decisions or you can't really be very effective. But I think the downside of that is that it leads to a certain amount of arrogance about what's right and what's right for everybody.
So, Robert, talk about the patterns that urban areas tend to form and then form suburbs and exurbs and then have infill come in and sort of erase the boundaries between them.
Well, I think that, yes, that certainly happens. But one of the things to keep in mind when you're talking about this is that, for example, in the United States in the last 100 years, we've seen increasingly these layers that go out and further and further and further, for, as you would describe it, from inner city to the inner suburbs, then to the outer suburbs, then to exurbs, and then to these far-flung places that are in communication with the city but very far out. But it's important to remember that there's always people circulating among these. So the person that grows up in the suburbs and is a 15-year-old just can't stand that suburb of Dallas, so will move right into the city at the very first moment they can. Then they'll have some children, and then they decide that, well, that little apartment in the center of Dallas isn't really very convenient, and so they move back out to probably a different suburb. So there's a continuous cycle. Now, what happened for much of American history was that cycle was overwhelmingly toward going further out, that more people were moving out than were moving in. Mm-hmm. What's happened recently, not that more people have been moving in, but that people aren't necessarily moving out any further. So the most elite places in American cities are typically the places that were built up to the 1920s and not since then. And this is less true in the really booming cities of the South and the West, like a place like Dallas. But even here, a lot of park cities, for example, these are places that maintain their cachet and, if anything, are increasing their cachet rather than having those people move all the way out to the fringe. So it looks like that chain, what looked like an inevitable chain of moving further and further out, may have been broken in the United States. And if it's so, then it's probably following in the pattern that European cities have been doing for 100 years now.
Well, when you talk about the 1920s, I wonder if there is any relationship to the fact that some of these exclusive areas were built before it was assumed that every household had a car or two. Are they somehow more walkable and therefore more desirable?
That could be, although remember that if you're talking about a very affluent suburb from the 20s, they already had cars.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they had a train station usually in these places, and so you had some choice, but the cars were already in affluent places, were already a fixture. And I think that may have been a very comfortable mix, that you had the railroad because it was there from the previous kind of city, but you also had the car. And I think an awful lot of people would like that today, which I think is why those neighborhoods remain so desirable. They are typically fairly low in density, but they have both the transit and the car. Now, so you say, well, why can't we just reproduce this all through the rest of the metropolitan area? Well, the problem is that particularly as the metropolitan area gets bigger and bigger, and the density has gone down now to such a point that you can't really support transit. You can support transit at the very center of the largest American cities, but you can't really support a comprehensive transit system with population densities below about 10,000 people per square mile. And a place like Dallas, the urbanized area, is way below that. It's 3,000 people per square mile. So most of Dallas will never be able to have a comprehensive rail system or even a bus system. So people by necessity are going to be getting around by something like automobiles, although I don't think it's going to be automobiles forever.
So is it wasted effort to try and put together a robust public transit system?
No, I don't think that's true at all, but I think it has to be very carefully targeted. So I think, for example, going from a downtown to an airport, these are usually transit systems that work very well because you're talking about going from places that have 30, 40, 50,000 people or more employed to other places with that similar kind of employment characteristics. So it's going to work. Trying to connect all of the remote areas is almost certainly not going to work.
My guest is Robert Brugman. He is professor emeritus at the University of Illinois at Chicago and author of the 2005 book Sprawl, A Compact History. He's in town to deliver the keynote address that will open the second annual David Dillon Symposium tonight and tomorrow in Dallas. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Robert Brugman, professor emeritus at the University of Illinois at Chicago and author of the 2005 book Sprawl, A Compact History. He'll deliver the keynote address tonight to open the second annual David Dillon Symposium that takes place tonight and tomorrow in Dallas. If you want to be part of our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think at KERA.org. It's interesting to me, Robert, that at one point we argued against urban blight, and now we are dismayed by sprawl. Is there a parallel to those two arguments?
Yes, I think there are mirror images of each other. And I think that you can say that urban blight, which was usually too much density, mm-hmm. was considered the great urban evil from the beginning of time until quite recently, until the 20th century, really. And then a whole series of things having to do with sanitation, good water supply, good sewer systems, air conditioning, suddenly made it possible to live comfortably at high densities. At the very same moment, so many people had moved out of the city that we suddenly said to ourselves, well, this is what we've wanted for 2,000 years, but now that we've got it, we don't like what we see. So, yeah, I think these are absolutely mirror images of each other. And, of course, each one of them had a formula and an answer. The answer for the first one was get the density down. And now our reflex action, at least among most planners, is let's get the density back up again. And I don't know that either of them is right or wrong. I don't think there's an optimum way to live in the city in an urban area. So I think that it really depends on the person and it depends on their point in life and their station in life.
Lots of people will say, okay, fine, it's the choice of whoever wants to live in a particular area according to what they can afford. But there's the question of environmental sustainability. And you have argued that the automatic assumption that living in a densely packed urban area is more sustainable than living in a suburban area is not necessarily true.
Correct. And I think that if you look at across history and across time, what you find is that energy use, and energy use today equates also with global warming, with climate change. If you look at that over time, you find that it's inexorable that the more affluent people are, the more energy they use. Now, there are variations. They use a little bit, considerably less energy, actually, in an average household in Paris than they do in, let's say, Dallas, Texas. But that is really quite small compared to the difference between what affluent people in the Western world use in the way of energy compared to, let's say, very poor people in Africa and Asia. So I don't think that that the difference that you see is really because of density or not. I think it's mostly having to do with affluence. Now, the other thing to be said is that a lot of recent studies have shown that, in fact, a lot of the densest areas use more energy than the less dense areas. And the best survey that we've ever had of energy use in the world has come out of Australia. And this was an enormous study that tracked every BTU of energy used. What they showed was that central Sydney, central Melbourne, used a good deal more energy per capita than if you did all the total amount of energy than people out in the suburbs. And the reason that's so interesting is because in Australia, unlike here, the more affluent people live at the center and the people of more modest means live at the periphery, which again suggests that not necessarily as an ironclad rule, but it is largely affluence that drives energy use.
And in terms of traffic congestion, there's also the phenomenon. We imagine that people move out of the center city but come back in every day and commute back into work. And those patterns seem to have really dissolved from what they were, 20, 30 years ago.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And the newer the city, the more it's the case. So if you look at New York or you look at Tokyo, let's say, they're overwhelmingly people are coming into the center. But if you look at Dallas, if you look at Houston, you look at even more so at Phoenix, you see that it's definitely a multinucleated place where people are going in all directions. And in fact, the commute out of the center and let's say the during the afternoon rush, where you'd expect people to be commuting out of the center, very often the commute is the reverse of what you would expect, that it's a reverse commute because there will be more jobs in, let's say, the Post Oak Galleria district than there are downtown, people commuting by car. So it's yes, the whole world is turned topsy-turvy in terms of where people go. And the commute between suburb and suburb is in almost every major city now greater than the commute from the suburbs into the center.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Beth in Plano. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Hi, sorry. I'm calling from Plano, yes, and I grew up here. And then as your guest said earlier, I moved into Central Dallas in my 20s. And having had my son at 30, I have of necessity moved back to Plano, actually living with my folks. And however, a lot of my friends from high school who have kids actually never left the Plano area, and a lot of them have moved to Frisco and Allen and McKinney. And really don't have any kind of relationship with Dallas as a city itself. And so I had just noticed your speaker, had said that the kind of tendency to go out was being broken. And I know he did accept some western and southern cities, but as for Dallas, I really see that continuing. You know, the sprawl is continuing to grow up 75 towards McKinney with a whole bunch of density. So, I just wanted to kind of share that was my experience. And, you know, my friends have stayed not in the same suburb usually, but going to, like you were saying earlier, the exurbs. And I wanted to offer that as the trend in our community.
Thanks for your call, Beth. I really appreciate it.
No, I'd say that observation is exactly right on. When I said the chain was broken, what I was talking about was primarily the most affluent people are no longer moving out. A lot of people today are observing that cities are gentrifying in their central city. Certainly Dallas is doing that dramatically. They seem to think that that means that more people are moving into the center city. Well, it's true, but actually the number of people moving to the edge is still considerably greater than moving into the center city. And one of the reasons for that is that when people move into the center city, they often move into the center city and they like it the way it is. And so they would be horrified with the idea that their three-story building is going to be replaced with a 50-story building. And so the same urge to stop sprawl at the edge is at play in the inner cities. And that's why even cities that are thriving, just thriving, and I guess Paris is the greatest example. Here's a city that was over 3 million people earlier in this century and is now earlier in the 20th century and is now down to barely over 2 million people. Exactly because of this, that as people become richer, they want more space and they want to control their environment. They want to preserve it. So I think the observation that people are still moving out to Plano and to Prosper and Frisco is exactly true. But I think that overall, the density is actually going up in the Dallas urbanized area and not going down. Lot sizes are getting smaller.
Is there any change, Robert, in people's identification with their home city, which might be a suburb or an exurb, feeling more part of that community than the community that they are supposedly sort of a bedroom town for?
I don't know how much of a change there has been, and it depends on whether you're talking about somebody going to Europe and being asked, where are you from? And you're more likely there to say you're from Dallas than you are from Plano, let's say. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about sports teams, there's very often a regional feeling. But I do think that as the jobs have moved out and as we have these centers of great
culture,
numbers
shopping,
of job, culture
jobs.
Shopping, yeah, that because it's all moved out, I think a lot of people now identify with the sub-region and mm-hmm. not with the larger region, because so many people now in the suburbs really don't go into the city at all. There's very little for them to do unless they really want to go to something that's very specific to a central city like the art museum or the symphony.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Jim in Dallas. Hey, Jim.
Hi, thanks. I notice that every city has ethnic and social neighborhoods. Do these types of clusterings create or encourage this sprawl? That's basically what I was curious about. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I don't know that they create the sprawl, but they've followed along with the diaspora out of the city, the move out of the city. So if you look at the pattern, the traditional pattern in American cities, you'll see the minorities will come into the very center. So if you look at New York City, they come into the Lower East Side, and then eventually they move out to Brooklyn and then move further out into, let's say, Long Island. Now, interestingly, what's happened here in the United States in the last 20 or 30 years has been that there is so much growth out in the suburbs and so many centers of jobs and other activities that we're starting to see immigrant groups not coming into the center at all. Partly that's because of gentrification of the center, but partly it's because we've started these new colonies of, let's say, people from India and Pakistan that will now move into the Chicago region, and they don't move into the very center. They'll move into the northwest suburbs 15, 20 miles away because there's already an established colony there. So I think we're looking at a scatteration of these minorities, typically moving out in a single direction along a transit line or a superhighway, but now we're starting to see people coming in and actually settling out at the periphery.
So obviously one concern about gentrification is that not only do you price, you know, individuals out of their own neighborhoods over time, but you lose the ability for people to be mixed in the same community according to ethnicity and race and also according to income. And I wonder if that's any different in the average suburb or exurb. Are people any more likely there to be living in economically diverse communities than they are in gentrified urban areas?
I'd say increasingly not. As the suburbs have become much more like the city in ways good and bad, mm-hmm. that is, high culture has gone out to the suburbs, but so has crime, so has drugs. And the city itself, the central city itself, which used to have a lot of poor people, increasingly, if it's a very successful downtown, let's say San Francisco, the poor people are being pushed out. So as the city becomes more like the suburbs and the suburbs become more like the city, we're looking at a kind of remarkable convergence in American urban patterns.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Eric in Southlake. Hi, Eric.
Chris, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question has to do with telecommuting. There's a lot of people out here in Southlake and surrounding communities who telecommute, mm-hmm. you know, at least a few days a week, and just curious about the impact on sprawl, or I guess as an enabler of sprawl, and whether or not we'll see, you know, towns in the future that are completely detached from larger metropolitan areas, kind of centered around telecommuting workforce.
I think that what's interesting about any technology is that it's almost always a double-edged sword. So, for example, the railroad in the 19th century allowed people to come into the city, but it also allowed them to move out of the city. I think that telecommunications is the same way. It could well be that in the future we'll have increasing number of people who want to live in an isolated mountaintop in Montana because they can, for the first time in human history, do that and still live in a kind of urban community, even though it's urban only because of its connection on the internet and package delivery and so on. But interestingly enough, it appears that for people who spend a lot of their time telecommuting and a lot of time on the computer, some of these are the very same people who find themselves rather lonely and they want company. And so they're very often the very people who want to move into, let's say, downtown Manhattan. So I think that it's too early to tell. Telecommuting certainly has had a big influence on American cities, but I'm not sure whether it's been in one direction or the other.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Adam in Dallas. Hi, Adam.
Yeah, hi. My question was, it seems like, you know, on the outskirts of Dallas, you had a lot of small rural towns like the Colony and Frisco. And, you know, recently, in the recent years, they've been doing a lot of development and building up, almost like they're trying to build themselves their own private cities. I'm talking about all the rich people. I just wanted to know if you had anything about that.
Well, I think that segregating out has always been a function of cities. So Yes, indeed. I think some of these far-flung places, particularly ones with gated communities, large-scale gated communities, are setting up barriers for people that are considered unlike the people that are in those communities. But, you know, in a way, this isn't very different from the private gated communities of 19th century London, or for that matter, a co-op or a condominium building with a doorman in Manhattan or central Dallas. So I think that, yes, this is a tendency toward segregating out, and this may be a bad thing for American democratic society, but I certainly don't think it's new, and I don't think it's specifically due to the suburbs.
We should talk about the fact that there are, for many people, very real benefits to feeling that they are in their own space, that they have their own little bit of grass that are not available to them in sort of high rent districts in very urban areas.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's been some research, historical research lately, that I find very interesting, which shows that the big environmental groups like the Sierra Club had a huge growth after World War II. A lot of that growth was suburban. And so you say to yourself, this sounds a little bizarre at first glance that these people that live in places where they chewed up all this wilderness in order to build housing, that these are people who are so interested in conservation. But when you think about it for a moment, you realize that actually the people that are in the city, they would like more parks and they would like the important national park, let's say, within easy access. The people in the suburbs, it's largely the same thing, but they want it even closer. It's a kind of backyard preservation where they want their own wilderness right in the out the back door from the kitchen. So I think that, yeah, this connection with land is something that probably is, again, ingrained in human beings. Notice how many people, if they live in high-rise apartment buildings or multi-story apartment buildings generally, if they have enough money, how likely they are to get second houses someplace out far where they can have more land and a natural scenery.
My guest is architecture historian Robert Brugman. He is in town to deliver the keynote address that will open the second annual David Dillon Symposium tonight. The symposium takes place tonight and tomorrow in Dallas. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The second annual David Dillon Symposium takes place tonight and tomorrow in Dallas. UT Arlington's School of Architecture is a presenter and sponsor of the Dillon Symposium. And we have with us this afternoon one of the keynote speakers, the keynote speaker actually for tonight's event. Robert Brugman is professor emeritus at the University of Illinois at Chicago and author of the 2005 book Sprawl, A Compact History. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. How does the presence of, if you want to call it sprawl, around an urban center affect life and culture within the center of the city?
I think that the usual answer to that question from most people has been that it saps the energy of the city, that because people have moved out, they take with them tax base and energy. I think you can look, and you see this particularly in the North and East, in these old cities of the North and East. Let's take Youngstown, Ohio, which is in very dire straits. On the other hand, you can look at it in a different way, which is you can say that if Youngstown, which had lost its main support, which was the steel industry, if it hadn't been for all that land out there, that was cheap land that wasn't very useful for agriculture and that was really very scenic land, if it hadn't been for that, Youngstown as a region might have simply gone down the chute. But because it had that ability to grow, and some of those professional people, the lawyers, the doctors, could move out from the central city, which was struggling, that may have been the salvation. So I think that there's always been a synergy back and forth between the suburbs and the sprawl out on the one hand and the center city on the other.
What kind of assumptions go into a term like smart growth and what that means?
Well, obviously, smart growth is a polemic, and you're supposed to believe that it's the opposite of dumb growth, which is what I think the anti-sprawl crusaders believe that we've been doing for the last 50 years. It's also related to the no-growth and slow-growth movements of the 1960s, and I think that what happened there was that these movements, which tried to stop growth altogether, they were really unsuccessful, and they created a backlash because what that meant was that if you don't have growth in this community, because the population is going to grow, it's just going to go someplace else. So you just send your problems somewhere else. So I think that smart growth was a way to address those. And I think there's a lot to be said positive about smart growth and about the new urbanist movement. I think they're trying to create a kind of ambiance that you used to have in communities back before we started the this terrific post-war suburbanization. And I say more power to them. I think it's providing a definite need in a particular part of the market, but it's probably not for everybody. And so I think that that as long as it's a choice and not something that's imposed on everybody, it's a smart growth has been a very good force.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Armand in Dallas. Hi, Armand.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I'm a real estate broker who specializes in the senior market, and I'm finding that with the baby boomer and our aging population, what they're looking for is more of a aging-in-place type of situation or single-family, you know, that type of living, or maybe even going back into the city where there's more dense population, where they have all the conveniences, zero lot line properties. So I think as we age or as age population, there's going to be a huge demand for a specific type of housing and location that I find is necessary. What do you think about the demographics of our aging population?
So glad you brought that up, Armand. Thank you.
Oh, I agree with that analysis completely. You can see that in the city, tremendous numbers of seniors are moving in because they can walk wherever they want to go. Very often, you'll see in a lot of communities, particularly struggling communities, that the biggest building in town, the First National Bank of whatever the little town is, has now become and particularly the big hotels have become senior living. That's true also in the suburbs, though, that a lot of suburbs are now densifying, particularly suburbs, old suburbs that have railroad stations all across the country. We're seeing high-rise apartment living right adjacent to those suburbs. And here's something I think ought to happen, and here's a tip for all you real estate people out there of something that I think is a market that needs to be captured. Why don't we see more housing not at shopping centers, but on top of shopping centers? Here's all that space that's wasted, all that parking that isn't used in the evening. And in many cases, a lot of these are now the transit malls. They're the place where the transit comes in, the buses, and then the bus you can get from there to the hospitals and back downtown. Why not put a green roof on top of these big regional shopping centers and then put some high-rise senior housing on top of it? That's what I would do if I were going to invest a couple of tens of millions of dollars.
It is pretty genius because it combines like convenient living with America's favorite pastime.
Yes, indeed.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Sarah on the line in Plano. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I just tuned in. I don't know if y'all have gone over this, but I have made an observation, which is something I didn't know before. The young people that graduate from college, they seem to go down or uptown. They rent apartments uptown so they can be close to the nightlife, and sometimes their work is also uptown or downtown. But also there's some of those young people that also work outside of that, you know, work, say, in Plano. They work on Legacy, and they live uptown for the entertainment. And empty nesters or retired people, I've heard, is a trend. It was actually an article written a few years ago in the Dallas Morning News about how retirees and empty nesters, they trade in their old house for a condo they buy uptown for the entertainment or maybe for the restaurants.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for that call, Sarah. I mean, what you just described with older folks, empty nesters moving downtown to a condo is what we just discussed in the previous call. And then this idea of the reverse migration is something you touched on earlier.
Yeah, the reverse commute is really interesting. It's very counterintuitive to expect that people are streaming out of the city in the morning and streaming into the city in the evening. But you see that in city after city, and it's usually in a single direction. So in the case of Dallas, it's probably to the north. In the case of most cities, it's in the direction of the most desirable housing, because that's also where a lot of the upscale jobs are created. I think one of the things that it is also happening in the center city that we haven't talked about is the fact that with this gentrification has come a clearing out of a lot of uses in the center city. Center cities used to have a lot of warehousing, a little light manufacturing. They used to have a whole range of activities. As we have more and more affluent people moving in, rents go up, and a lot of these activities then move out. And so we're getting more and more of a kind of monoculture in the central city that used to be a little bit more diverse. Now, that may not be a bad thing. That may be a very good thing. It may be that the center city is specializing in what it can do best, but it's clearly a trend.
It is interesting because we assume that the vibrant quality of a city comes from the fact that so much goes on there. And you're right. It becomes way too expensive to have like a giant garage downtown or that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. That garage is likely to come down and in its place. And you know, what I really notice a lot of is the way we're losing the gas stations in the mm-hmm. central city, which is probably a good thing. It's probably not a great idea to have a lot of gas stations right in the central city on very expensive land. On the other hand, when you're driving around and you're trying to get gasoline, it can be a real problem these days. You haven't gotten that far in Dallas with that, but boy, you go to Manhattan and try to find a gas station. Boy,
I hadn't thought
help.
About that. Well, of course, a lot of people in Manhattan now, it seems like it's only cabs that are driving passenger cars. There's not a lot of individuals, are there, behind the wheel?
There are a tremendous number of individuals.
Are there?
Oh, yes. There are huge numbers of cars. It's not that they're used every day, generally, because it's just so expensive and so unpleasant to try to get around in Manhattan in your own car, but tremendous, tens of thousands of them, and they're parked in garages all over the city. Most of these people have to drive some distance and usually out of Manhattan just to be able to get some gasoline.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Lana on the phone in Dallas. Hi, Lana.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
I live in an area in Dallas that is close to Bishop Arts, so it's in an older area that has older houses and some nice houses and other things. It maybe are, so it's being revitalized is what's happened. It's become popular, and they recently built on a street that goes into Bishop Arts called Davis. They built some apartments, and they're about three stories tall, and there's a lot of them. They're right up next to the street. There's a sidewalk, and then the apartments start. Behind that, there's parking. So what happens if you get a lot of things that are like that in an area that has streets that are kind of, in some areas, pretty narrow?
Well, certainly traffic has been an issue in cities for a long time and is also an issue in suburbs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think this is another case where we see that when people are coming into an area that have more are more affluent than the ones that they're displacing, one of the very first things they do is try to push down the zoning. So we see across the country in affluent downtown areas and near downtown areas a big push to preserve the neighborhood. And preserving the neighborhood means to push down the zoning envelope. On the other hand, that's completely counter to a lot of smart growth and new urbanist ideas, where they believe that in order to have a vibrant neighborhood, you want to have a lot more density, particularly if you want to support transit. So I think these ideas are in direct collision, and it'll be interesting to see how they play out neighborhood by neighborhood. One thing that is interesting is that if you have enough money, you can usually protect yourself from most of these things happening. So I think that with enough money, you can stop change. That's one thing that I think urban areas have always been about, is ceaseless change, and change that in many cases even the most powerful members of society can't stop. But in some cases, if you have enough money and you've got the legal tools, you can have neighborhoods. Well, I think you can see them here in Dallas, in some of the most affluent central neighborhoods, that you pretty much can stop change, but it takes a lot of doing.
How are patterns of sprawl in the United States different from or comparable to patterns of sprawl in Europe?
They're largely the same with a time lag. So in Britain, for example, London was sprawling really dramatically already by the 19th century, and it continued up to the present. That was because it was the wealthiest, largest and wealthiest city. As you go further and further along in time, you see the cities that are less wealthy, particularly cities of the south and east of Europe, starting to sprawl. All of those cities are still sprawling. All of those cities are still losing density in the overall urbanized area. Not true in the U.S. In the U.S., the sprawl was earlier. But what we're seeing now is we're seeing, particularly in the lowest density cities in the American West and South, those densities are actually going up, and nowhere more dramatically than Los Angeles. Now, this is incredibly ironic because Los Angeles was for decades the poster child for sprawl. But Los Angeles is one-third, the Los Angeles urbanized area is one-third denser than it was in the 1950s. It's now 7,000 people per square mile. It is the densest urbanized area in America, in the United States. And people say, well, how can that be? You know, nothing there is like New York City, like Manhattan. True. But it doesn't have much in the way of abandoned land. The lot sizes have always been smaller. And when the city ends, the urbanized area ends, you have desert beyond. So overall, that density is extremely high. And by the way, it's that density that causes most of the problems that people think about when they're thinking about L.A., terrible traffic. That's a matter of traffic is a function of density. And that's why the traffic is so bad. L.A. had a great start on the highway building, but they largely stopped in the 70s. So today, if you compare, let's say, Dallas with Los Angeles, Dallas overwhelmingly more freeway miles or in tollway miles per capita than Los Angeles. In fact, Los Angeles has one of the smallest number of lane miles of superhighway in the country.
And we'll always want to be able to get where we're going as quickly as possible. That's not going to change.
No, that's not going to change. But what I think will change is this debate between public transit and the automobile. The automobile is just as much a 19th century technology as the bus and the train. And now that we have driverless cars and we have shared vehicles, we have all kinds of technology that could mean that we won't have to deal with some of those problems of the automobile that we've had in the past. With alternate fuel, let's say it's a driverless car that's on demand, you type into your computer and it comes up, you get in this little capsule and you go 200 miles an hour through Dallas, this may solve a lot of the problems that we've had with the automobile.
My guest this hour has been Robert Brugman, author of Sprawl, A Compact History. He'll deliver the keynote address to open the annual David Dillon Symposium tonight. That is, of course, sponsored and presented by the UT Arlington School of Architecture. Robert, it's been wonderful to have you. Thank you so much.
It's been great being here.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And Jeff Whittington is our executive producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.